Hello, dumplings. Welcome to Let's Get Ugly, the podcast where we dive deep into the latest beauty, wellness, and lifestyle secrets that aren't always pretty, but always real.
We're your co-hosts, Trisha and Disha.
The sister duo keeping it 100% authentic, really sassy and silly all at the same time.
We are definitely silly, but come join us, grab your favorite drink, and let's get ugly.
So today we have Rosie Viva with us. Rosie, welcome to Let's Get Ugly.
Thanks. Thank you for having me here.
Of course. I mean, your journey from being a model to obviously navigating your life with bipolar and being an activist in that space is so amazing. And we can't wait to talk to you about how you've navigated your journey.
I actually think your openness is super inspiring. When you talk about the experiences you've had from the highs and lows of bipolar to even thriving on your career, you've shown so much resilience. I want to start with a really pivotal moment. Let's talk about Stansted Airport.
My favorite topic.
Your favorite topic. How did that pivotal experience shape the path you're on today? And could you give us like a little overview for the listeners to, you know, what happened?
So when you referenced Stansted Airport, so in 2018, I received my diagnosis of bipolar 1 disorder on a day where I went into psychosis for the first time, which is a sort of natural state for someone with bipolar having a traumatic moment. And in Stansted Airport, it was supposed to be a day I got a flight to go and be with my parents in Croatia. I'd just gone through a breakup with my ex-boyfriend, and I think it was a moment of crisis where everything sort of built up after a year struggling with my mental health, having anxiety and depression, and this is sort of a breaking point. But because of the hallucinations, I was very out of touch with reality, and I guess I thought I was dreaming, or I didn't really know what was real and what wasn't real. So I jumped through baggage drop-off and hit a fire alarm on my left-hand side and set off the fire alarms there. And then I was arrested. And within 24 hours, I was very obviously showing signs of bipolar. And so instead of going to a police station, I was sent to A&E. And then 24 hours after being in A&E, I was then sectioned in Ealing Hospital and later given the diagnosis.
Has it shaped? Of course it has. Yeah. How has it shaped the path you're on today?
I think looking back, that was obviously quite a pivotal moment because I realized how serious mental health could be. And I also realized that it wasn't a sort of linear topic and it wasn't black and white. It was so diverse and so different for everyone. But it made me realize the severity of mental health if it's untreated and if you're not getting the care you need. So for me, that was the start of learning to manage something I didn't know I had before. And I think although it was a really difficult year after that point, when you know what you're dealing with, then you know that there's certain medications, you know that there's certain therapies, and suddenly you're receiving the support you need. So it was really pivotal in learning to manage, I guess.
Definitely. And I mean, in terms of your documentary that you created, Modeling Mania in Me, how did it feel like sharing your story? Did you find it a healing experience after the fact, or?
When I was filming it, it was very surreal and it was actually quite an insular thing. I knew that I was sharing a lot, but it wasn't what you're used to when sharing. You know, if you're sharing on social media every day, you feel like you're giving, whereas this was sort of 6 months of being filmed and knowing I was about to share. So in that time, it was actually very sort of calming and there was no judgment. You were just acting how you usually act every day and recording something, but it wasn't a real-time reaction. But I would say it was very healing in that I knew I was putting out something really true to myself. There was no sort of acting involved when you're with the director for 6 months. They're going to capture every angle. They're going to capture every moment. And because I trusted the director and we had such a friendship, I knew that she was putting out something true to me. But I would say when you sort of share something so raw and intimate, everything now feels really easy because it's like the world's seen you in your low moments and seen you in your high moments. And so it was actually just very nice to be so honest. And then the reaction from people with bipolar was just, I mean, we had so hundreds of comments on the YouTube and I was so worried about that platform and how much people can write things behind a keyboard. But there was two comments which were a bit mean and even those were just quite funny. Whereas there was hundreds of people who could relate. So it just unlocked my sort of belief that it was important to talk up about something not spoken about, I guess.
It's a really brave move. And I think also it's interesting because obviously it's an even more brave move because you say that there's often more shame about the highs of bipolar than the lows. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is? And how did you decide to showcase that in the documentary?
I sort of, with the documentary, I didn't want to, and the director was the same as me, we didn't want to give too much narrative in terms of what makes me high and what makes me low, because I'm someone who has like a very privileged life and I didn't want to be tone deaf to my issues being sort of very different to someone else living with this. So a lot of it, we just wanted to show the energy and how that comes across high and low and how everyone with bipolar sort of has this similar experience, no matter what their background, where they're from, you're all hit with this thing to manage. So nice to sort of show with emotion on my face rather than too much narrative. The highs are harder to show even in my day-to-day life. They're so misunderstood. In my case, whenever I've gone through grief or a breakup, I go high. And so for a lot of my friends and family, a lot of people will think that you're slightly sort of psychopathic and you can't deal with emotion, but it's actually just a very different way of dealing with emotion. And so I just feel strongly to raise awareness that you can't jump to sort of judge someone because it's not always in everyone's control how they react. Hopefully the footage showed it just by small nuances, which other people with bipolar obviously picked up on and resonated with. And I don't think we all understand how it works yet.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I remember when I was watching it that you had your breakup and you shared about how you're more cautious about mm-hmm. relationships now. How do you kind of approach dating and trust with the kind of diagnosis when talking about it to people as well?
I go through patches. I think it's like anyone who deals with mental illness will be able to relate to the person you're dating makes such an impact on how you speak about it and how you feel speaking about it. So sometimes it just won't feel relevant to bring it up. And then other times it feels natural to open up to that person. Often if they sort of put out a lifeline and speak about something they're dealing with, you always want to compensate and let them know that you've also got stuff you deal with. So it's sort of balanced. It's definitely made me more cautious about dating, but this year I went through a breakup and that was always my biggest fear when I was filming the documentary was what happens if I fall in love and then it doesn't go well? Will I have another episode? And then I think this year was just really special to be able to deal with a trigger in the past and be fine. I did go high for a month, but I knew this time around what to do in that situation. Whereas when I was 22, that sort of emotion happened and I didn't know what was going on, and that's why the whole Stansted thing happened. So it's also nice to sort of face your fears and realize that you do get better at managing your illness.
It sounds like open conversations about mental health is something that's been a really positive impact in your trajectory since then. Mm-hmm. Do you have like any strategies for somebody that would be looking to do this? So is there something that you could recommend to somebody if they were looking to have a conversation personally with people close to them in their lives for the first time? What advice could you give them?
I think it's for me, it was really empowering to read a lot of books about people who speak openly about their bipolar. So before I went into speaking publicly, I read so many different accounts and it just built up my confidence that my voice was authentic and my experience was different to other people's. And that's where you realize that it's so valuable to tell your family and friends about your experience because they're only going to understand it if it comes from you. So that would be my advice, is just keep telling yourself that whatever you say and whatever information you give over is going to be way more valuable than any book someone else could read about, especially if someone's looking to support you.
That's amazing. I mean, especially this time around that it happened like a few years after the fact, what have you kind of learned about balancing, you know, your vulnerability and your mental health in relationships?
I think it's really, really good to be vulnerable. And I always think if it's the right person, then it's just not, you've got to stop telling yourself that it's a burden to be open and to be vulnerable, because I think when it's the right person, they want to support you and they want to show up for you. So if I've learned anything about being bipolar and being in a relationship, it's just to be as communicative as possible and just let that person learn with you, because it is an ongoing process. especially in your 20s with bipolar. It's like every year there's different triggers. Some things which used to send me low don't send me low anymore because I've learned to sort of build up a resilience towards them, but then new things will happen which will sort of wobble me. So I guess it's just trusting your gut with the fact that someone else is sort of open to learning, even if they're not directly affected.
It's amazing. I think it's a good outlook to have on it, especially because your 20s are probably, they say it's like the most tumultuous time in your life, right? Because you're learning things and figuring things out. So definitely to keep that in check is really important.
Speaking of kind of empowering yourself, mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about your career so far. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask whether it was the runway or being behind the camera or now DJing, what has been the most empowering moment for you in your career so far?
For me, it was the biggest modeling job I ever got. It was when I was modeling for Gucci. And I think I'd had a few years in the industry seeing other girls have those career highs and always thinking, will I ever be that person? And I think the more you sort of manifest it, the more confidence you give out and the more you tell people that that's your trajectory, the more likely it is to happen. So it was just really nice, even though I'm not working for a big brand doesn't make you any more successful in modeling as someone working for a small brand, but doing 5 days a week. It's not, it's just a different type of success. But because I'd put importance on setting my sights on something and achieving it, I think that was my proudest moment.
I love that.
That's incredible. In terms of the fashion industry, have you found them to be supportive of mental health discussions, or do you think there's more work the industry needs to do?
It's a difficult one because modeling is a very sort of lonely job within the industry. Like you're working for different brands every day, so you don't have consistent relationships, and that's the best part and the worst part of the job, in that there's so much variety. You get to travel, you get to stay in different places. But I think in terms of my experience with having a mental health issue within that industry is that that also means it can get missed. Whereas now that I'm in a job where I go in 4 days a week and I'm with the same colleagues, if I have a patch where I'm unstable, it's much more likely to be picked up on. So I think there's a long way to go within fashion, but it's also just, if you are self-employed and you have a lot of time on your own and you have less structure, I think you've got to be extra sort of aware that if you go through a rough patch, you've got to reach out for help. And it's less likely that sort of colleague, you don't really have that colleague mentality where people are going to pick up on it as easily. So it's less that the conversation is there. It's more just if you're working with people for the first time, you don't go in on those deeper conversations. It's sort of a lot more surface conversation on a set in a studio, unless you're working with the same client regularly, I guess.
I think that's so interesting. And it is so true. Support that you get from people is like none than you can get from anywhere else, I find. Like it's incomparable. And there is something really special to be said about like a colleague relationship. We do spend a lot of time working, to be fair.
Yeah, we do. We spend a lot of time working and we spend a lot of time with our colleagues.
Yeah, for sure. We were researching and obviously we saw that running is your happy place.
Yes.
Why?
Why? Oh, do you know what? I always think it's like, I'm not saying this from a place of someone who's even particularly good at it, but I think the way you're sort of moving your body and doing it regularly is what has such an effect on me. Like, I'm not someone who will go out on a long run and come back and say, I've got a runner's high right now, I feel amazing. I never have that eureka moment. I just noticed that if I do it 3 times a week, my overall mood is better.
Okay.
And as someone who's always looking for things to help my mood, it's just been better than anything else for me. But I think also there's a lot of privacy with running, and there's a lot of fun in your own space with yourself, and it's somewhere with music where I feel like a sense of fun, and I feel quite childish with that sort of movement music thing. And I guess just anything you do on your own you enjoy is something to lean towards.
Definitely. What are the top three tracks on your running playlist at the moment?
Oh god. At the moment, I mean, I always go with, like, if I could give someone three running tracks, Happiness by Alexis Jordan, which is like a really old song. The beat to that, I always say, if you've never run before, you should do this. And then I would probably do like a Two Door Cinema Club.
Love.
As well. Like, I go very nostalgic with my music choices because I wouldn't listen to that otherwise. So then maybe like an MGMT song as well, like Time to Pretend. Like, yeah.
It's got to be Electric Feel.
Yeah.
It probably would be.
So yeah, that would be my choice. Like, go back and think about memories and use that time to reflect, because we're always sort of thinking about the future and what you could be doing, what you could be changing. Whereas for me, running is reflection time, I guess.
I feel like that probably helps a lot with the day-to-day to get clarity as well, mm-hmm. in terms of what your next moves would be, right? Because you do need to reflect to then decide what to do next in the long run, for sure. I mean, do you have any other things that you do to help boost your mood aside from running?
My main thing is always going to be relationships. The last 6 years, it's just been gravitating towards people who make me feel good. And that just is priceless. When you come away from seeing certain friends and you feel better than when you reached seeing them, there's just something in that which is so healing. And the more you do it and the more you spend time with those people, the more you build up a confidence in how to treat people, how people should make you feel, and what's really important. And those conversations are just so healing when it's with people who are genuinely there to support you. So I think especially when you get a diagnosis like this, you can't really drink as much. So you lose a lot of friends who you would only see in a drinking setting. And when you have to do things like running, then you meet people in that setting and you're sort of there sweating. There's nothing glamorous about it. So you just build up a whole new sort of routine with who you spend time with, I guess.
That's amazing. I wonder if Rosie can convince us to go running.
I don't know with me, you know. I'm busy that day. Well, speaking of upcoming projects, because we are so excited for you to share more details with us about this too, can you share with us something that you're excited about? What can you tell us about it?
So I'm releasing my first book. It comes out on May the 8th. I will have announced it on January the 21st. And it's called Completely Normal and Totally Fine. And it's a sort of self-deprecating account of living with bipolar as a young woman. So I read so many books and it's been so good to read them and to realize that everyone's got a different experience with this. But nothing was the way I speak to my friends about it, which is so conversational and just trying to sort of make a light of something dark and light. But I just wanted to write something in a sort of candid context. You know, everything online is super relaxed and memes and all the things I go to. I couldn't find anything about bipolar in that sort of sense. So that was my aim. And it's been really, really fun to write it.
So. That's amazing.
So exciting. Yeah. What was the most exciting part about writing it for you?
I think it was that I got to write, and I've written a diary since I was 12. I write for like 20 minutes every morning. When people say they journal, I'm like, oh God, I do 5 books a year. Like, it's really a lot. So I think my favorite part of it was the fact that I got to write, which is a love of mine. It's similar to running. I go into a flow, and I think whatever someone gets into a flow with is something they're meant to be doing. So it was really lovely to do that and actually have an editor work with me and sort of get better at a craft, which I'd never seen as something serious, but more of a hobby, I guess.
Sounds amazing. I mean, the fact that you were able to kind of share your story in a different way and create a resource for so many people to kind of look at as well is truly amazing. When it came to the writing process, obviously, because it must have been eye-opening to particular moments, maybe ones that were good, ones that were a bit more difficult. Mm-hmm. Was there anything in there that you'd be okay with sharing with us in terms of like a pivotal point in the book?
It's just been really nice to be so honest. And I think even like I said earlier, there's certain reactions you have with bipolar which you know aren't understood. So I lost my brother-in-law to suicide in lockdown, and the way I dealt with that was a high. And I think that period of time in my life, maybe people judged the way I was acting, and it was really nice to write from my point of view how that felt and the insecurities which come with that reaction. You know, like, am I human? Why can't I be sad? And did I not love them, sort of thing. So when my sister read the book for the first time and her hearing my voice in that situation, it was just really like a really special moment for me. So definitely something which has been the best part about writing it is just being honest.
I think that that's really, really difficult for a lot of people to do, you know, like being honest with yourself and being honest within circumstances is really a tough one. I'm so excited to actually read your book.
Wow. I think it will be an easy read, which is nice. Yeah. Everyone who's read it has read it quickly, and it's not too heavy, but about quite an important topic. So it's a nicer way to digest something. And you never know who you're going to know in your life who's affected by bipolar. And I hope that someone would read it who doesn't know about it. But then if they have a friend who's got depression but isn't reacting well to antidepressants, who has these highs, you might go, hang on, how have I never thought that this person might have the wrong diagnosis? And that's what I would like to trigger in the average reader, I guess, just to be aware.
I mean, do you feel like this is a serious question, with the healthcare system in terms of how it's like over here in the UK, do you think they do get diagnoses right a lot of the time, or is bipolar one of those that is a bit trickier to diagnose?
It's really hard. So the average diagnosis is 10 years.
Wow.
From the moment that someone seeks help and goes to a GP and says, I'm struggling, the average person will take 10 years to get the right diagnosis. So I think, especially because in my case, I was going to the doctor and saying I've got depression, but I'd never learned that being high is a bad thing. So on my highs, I just thought, oh, this is a relief from what I'm dealing with. And thank God I feel good today. I never reported to a doctor that every week or every 2 weeks I'd have this euphoria, because I just thought, thank God I have it. So I think it's just a system which is so brilliant. But because we don't have this sort of 24-hour observation, we're still going to doctors and saying what we think we should say. And that's often just not knowing that bipolar is an option when you're sort of looking out for your symptoms and describing how you feel.
So in reality, if you weren't in A&E that day, if you weren't being observed for those 24 hours, you would have still been in the same cycle.
Because of the psychosis, so bipolar is type 1 and type 2. So people with type 2 might not ever have psychosis. Whereas type 1, because of the psychosis, you get a diagnosis much quicker. Mm. So it's like 18 to 22, the first time you go through something difficult or traumatic or like a life change, like going to uni or losing a parent, it's very easy for someone like me to get diagnosed. Whereas the difficulty comes with a lot of people who never have psychosis but have bipolar. And at that point, you can be so low or so high, but because you're not delusional, you wouldn't be sectioned. That's where it's really difficult. So as someone with type 1, I guess I want to speak openly about this for the sake of both people, but it's a very similar illness.
Yeah. We're going to move on to something a little bit more personal and quirky, I guess. The first question I have for you is, what's one outfit or piece that you've modeled that you wish you could have kept forever?
Do you know what? Sometimes it's like one of those things where it's a really gorgeous staple and you would just love to keep it and wear it every day. I did a shoot for a brand called With Nothing Underneath, which is a London-based brand, really nice simple white shirts, and I just thought, oh my god, if I dress like this every day I would feel amazing. Like, it's that classic really sort of simple but stylish woman. So I guess everything that day, all the styling, all the simple sort of suit trousers, and I just wish I could have kept that whole collection.
That sounds amazing. I mean, definitely something we could learn from.
Yeah. We have a lot of glitter. It's not
Do you have a go-to look for when you want to feel instantly fabulous, even on a day where you might not be feeling so great?
I think for me, I've always dressed quite androgynously. And I love a trouser suit because you're still not putting in too much effort and having to sort of dress up, but you feel so put together wearing matching. And it's just such a cool look. And it's like day to night. And yeah, if I ever want to have a day where I feel really amazing, I wear a trouser suit for that reason, that like from the get-go you feel really sort of, yeah, grown up and womanly and cool.
I love that. If you could shoot a fashion campaign anywhere in the world, where would it be and why?
If I could, okay, we've got to manifest this.
Yeah.
Where would I do it? I think it would probably be somewhere in America. I think maybe New York. I was there when I was younger for modeling. And it's just, I love the energy of New York. I love that American attitude to just go out and do things and not worry too much and not wait for someone else to sort of give something a go, but just go and do it. And so I'd always like my career to take me back to that city for some reason. I don't know yet.
Fair enough.
That sounds so exciting. I mean, we have beauty related questions.
Great.
Yeah.
That are quite quick fire. And we ask these ones to every guest.
Okay.
So what's one beauty rule you love breaking?
Mine's got to be a face routine. I know that sounds so silly, but every time I sort of see someone about my skin, or a friend will say, what do you use? And I just use a hot flannel. And I don't use anything else except moisturizer, and that changes all the time. But I think it's just knowing that with your skin, whatever works for you and whatever makes you feel good, that's the reason you have a face routine. So mine is just, I think after years of modeling and wearing so much makeup yeah. every day, I used to have really bad skin. And for me, even though I look less womanly and everything, I'm still in this real honeymoon period with not wearing makeup. So that would be the one thing I break. But I would love to try other people's routines. Like now, and then, now that I've had a break, I think I'm ready to come back. But it's definitely been a year without one.
Wow. If you could give your younger self one piece of beauty advice, what would it be? I bet this is going to be good, though, because everyone's set a lot.
Yeah, I think it would be, I mean, mentally having a break from modeling for the last year. And then last week I did my first shoot in a fashion environment for the first time. And it was just so nice when you've sort of learned who you are away from your appearance and had a career where you've developed skills and stuff, which are nothing to do with your appearance, to be back on set last week and be so confident. I wish I'd told my younger self that those small differences every day in your skin, or my hair's not good, or all of these things, no one else notices. And I just wish that I knew that a bit younger, that like everyone sees you for how happy you are and how you present yourself and what you're wearing, or how you're, you know, ways you want to make yourself look good is way more important than any small abnormality you have that day, which you can't control.
I think that's really beautiful, actually, because I think when you're younger, you do pick up on these things more, especially if you're exposed to that kind of set environment as well, where all eyes are on you and you're like, is anyone going to notice this? I think that's really great. Our final question is, what's a beauty moment on yourself, good or bad, that you'll never forget?
Mine would have to be a few weeks ago. So I went to Japan on holiday, and in all of the supermarkets, they sell these like beauty razors for women, like the small ones.
Dermaplaning.
Yeah. And so I got home and I was like, wow, this is so addictive. Like, because you get rid of all the small hair on your face and it feels so smooth to put on moisturizer. But I just completely did it wrong and I had scratches all here. It looked like a cat had grabbed my face. And,
oh my gosh.
And I just thought, why have I attempted this? Like, I just didn't know how to do it. So for a week, everyone just kept saying like, oh God, are you okay? And it was just like, honestly, cat scratches. That was probably my low point with beauty tips, I think.
So that one, seek expert advice.
Yeah. Or at least watch like a tutorial or something rather than just like trying.
Oh my gosh, did you just do it like you found it and then you were like, cool, I'm just gonna
and obviously because it was all in Japanese, I didn't understand the instructions, so I just like tried and then there was a lot of blood.
Oh yeah.
Okay, so we have a final segment where we do an oracle card reading with our beauty themed oracle cards, and it'll just be a question about the year ahead. I think that'll be nice. Yes, I'm feeling this one. Trust your instincts.
Okay.
That is your card for the year. So if there was anything that you felt that you were unsure of in any part of your life, now is the time to trust them. Also, Mercury just came out of retrograde, so we can trust our instincts again.
We can. Oh, well, I love that.
Rosie, thank you so much for sharing your journey with us today, your courage in tackling the stigma around mental health, both personally and in the fashion world, has been such an interesting thing to listen to, but I'm sure this conversation has made a massive impact on a lot of people's lives.
We are really grateful for your insight and honesty with us today, and I've really enjoyed talking to you, and we can't wait to see what's next.
Oh,
amazing.
Thank you so much for having me.
Have you ever wanted to take control of your health and truly understand your body? Flow is the number one female health app, trusted by over 380 million people worldwide. Co-created with more than 120 leading health and medical experts, Flow is your go-to for tracking periods, ovulation, and even pregnancy. And now you can get 30% off Flow Premium for a whole year with the code LGU. With Flow, you'll unlock personalized insights, expert advice, and everything you need to feel empowered every day. Download Flow now, and don't forget to use the code LGU for your exclusive discount.